with its pure water too.
You know it's WBAI when Max and I are just sitting around saying, well, how do you make this work? I don't even know if anybody's hearing me at this moment. But, my theme is there.
Okay.
That's fascinating, Max. I'm hearing it in my headphones. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated usually to science fiction, fantasy, the imagination, and enchantment. Well, we're going to have certainly many of those attributes. My guest this morning is Margot Atwell and Zach Ziss. Okay, so first a movie review and some music. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Here's a curious thing. My two favorite sequences from the new animated quasi-anthology film Khalil Gibran's The Prophet are both dance sequences. I have obvious reasons for favoring one of them. It's directed by Tom Moore, the Irish director of the Oscar-nominated The Secret of Kells and the equally wonderful Song of the Sea, and who here, in translating poet Khalil Gibran's thoughts on love to the screen, uses his unique style of situating characters within elaborately patterned backgrounds to tell the tale of a man and a woman who, in their dance of love, struggle against temptations and distractions which are rendered as red-caped, masked specters. It's easily the best sequence of the film, the deceptively elemental visuals conveying powerful emotions. The other sequence, devoted to Gibran's On Marriage, is executed by director Joanne Safar, best known for his animated feature The Rabbi's Cat, and is presented as a sensuous, passionate tango between two people on an abandoned terrace. Safar manages to exquisitely visualize the gives and takes of marriage into the shifting power exchange of the dance and doesn't seem too fazed by whether or not the visuals match up with the actual poem as read by Liam Neeson. And that may be key to my preference for these two sequences. A dance number, handled well, has its own narrative. The audio, whether a poem, a song, becomes support rather than the driver for the visuals. Gibran's poetry, while beautiful, and I should point out I've never read The Prophet. I was more a Carlos Castaneda guy in my college years, actually. But Gibran's words, while beautiful, can pose risks if adhered to too closely. Something animator Nina Paley, she of the very fine Sita Sings the Blues, finds out when her adaptation of On Children winds up with such uncomfortable imagery as a pregnant woman being bent back to form a bow with an arrow launched from her swollen stomach. It may represent empowerment, but was an awkward way of putting it, in my view. So yeah, the visualizations of the various poems that form the substance of Gibran's book are a mixed bag, but overall, pretty good. Among the rest, Michel Soka turns On Freedom into an attractively stark metaphor of birds tethered to a tree, and Bill Plimpton, whose adaptation of On Eating and Drinking salutes both agricultural and digestive processes, provides a welcome bit of impertinence, however mild, to a film that often wears its spiritual uplift too prominently on its sleeve. Where the film falters prominently and regrettably is with its framing story, which takes up a considerable portion of the running time and, as written and directed by The Lion King's Roger Allers, takes Gibran's narrative of Prophet imparting his wisdom to a group of villagers before his departure back home and turns it into a more elaborate affair that centers on a poet being deported from a fictional Middle Eastern country for his radical thoughts, a mischievous and mute girl, her put-upon mother, and a couple of bumbling officials escorting the poet to his ship. There's a legend that when Walt Disney first saw the pastoral segment for Fantasia, he exclaimed, "Gee, this will make Beethoven," which, depending on your view of Disney, can be regarded either as endearing naivety or stunning arrogance, or maybe both. I get the sense that Allers, with all good intentions, is trying to similarly make Gibran here, wrapping the more conceptual conceits of the poetry segments in an appealingly mainstream Disneyfied wrapper. The animation and performances are beautiful, no question, but the portrayal of the Middle Eastern culture and the seaport's villagers strays too frequently into broad caricature. At times, it has all the cultural nuance of Disney's Aladdin. And the poet, also voiced by Liam Neeson, is such a paragon of benevolence and empathy that he gets to be a little much after a while. You know, even Jesus got angry every now and then. Salma Hayek was closely involved in the production and voices the mother, by the way, but this is clearly a passion project for her. And one of the studios involved, Participant, which specializes in projects with socially minded, usually liberal agenda, has done many good films as well as some a little too weighty down in self-congratulation. The prophet does wander into the latter category a little too frequently, but still has rewards in allowing a wide range of animation artists the freedom to bring their own visions to the project. There is stuff that pleases, but you have to accept that there will be stuff that won't exactly please. Gibran himself would probably be happy with that balance. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, so catch up on what you missed by going to mightymoviepodcast.com.
They used to be labeled, says Max. Okay. And good morning. I'm away for 2 weeks, right? You know, because we have fundraising. And, of course, I get preempted for fundraising. Although I made good money two weeks ago.
And we've been to IKEA. Look at this desk.
Oh, is this IKEA?
Oh, this is IKEA all the way.
Actually, it's not bad.
Yeah.
Actually, it's not bad. I hope all of you at home can see this. What are my headphones? These?
Oh, no, actually, yours are now...
And why am I hearing a busy signal?
Because people don't hang up the phone when they're done with the phone. Did that go away?
Ah, yes. Well, you can tell by the inanity of the broadcasting that you're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, New York City, WBAI. At 99.5 FM. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. We have guests. It will be a wonderful show, but we have announcements. Number one, take your radio outside. Look to the northeast. The Perseid meteor shower. Right now, Earth is passing through the tail of a comet that we cannot see from here, but little microscopic things from, one of my guests knows how to operate the equipment far better than I do. We're going through these little microscopic bits of the tail of the comet, and they show up coming from the northeast as meteors. And you don't have to look to the northeast, you just have to look up. So lay back is the easiest way. If the sky isn't overcast and if you're in a place that doesn't have too much sky pollution, tonight and tomorrow night is the new moon, okay? So you have a better shot at seeing the Perseid shower than we've had since 2008, apparently. So enjoy it tonight and tomorrow night. It'll be through the month, but this is your best shot. Then the moon comes back, and it's even more light pollution from lunar sources. Okay, the other announcement. Oh, yes, I hope you all know that I run the New York Review of Science Fiction Reading series that is going to be starting its silver anniversary season, the 25th anniversary season, right here. At 388 Atlantic Avenue. And our first readers will be Rajan Khanna and Michael Swanwick. So, you know, we're starting good, okay? Admission is free, and I'll be telling you more about it as we get closer to the date. But closer to that, you know, you see, I'm not the only reading science fiction reading series in New York. Whoops. Now, why did that come up? Uh-huh. Where it says cart, huh? Yeah. The other reading series, the big competition, oh my God, how awful they are. I mean, they have people like N.K. Jemisin and A.C. Wise reading this coming Wednesday at the KGB bar at 84 East 4th Street. And it is absolutely wonderful. I mean, terrible, terrible. They're the competition. And admission is free. It starts at 7 o'clock. I really recommend getting there like 6:30 or so. The place fills up very quickly. And for Nora Jemisin, who we had last May, and AC Wise, who I was going to have, but when you see, we don't step on each other's toes. If they book somebody, we give a buffer. So that means I'll wait till next year, as they say in sports. So that's this coming Wednesday, 6 days from now, technically, at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Bar. Just look that up online with your favorite search engine, which is Google. And, I'm not partisan. And you'll learn more about it. Ours starts September 8th. And we have a good schedule, and they have a good schedule, and so there. Speaking of sports, and speaking of the Nursef readings. Okay, so a little over a year ago, I'm at BEA, which is the Book Expo of America. Are you leaving, Max?
Yeah, I think
so. Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
I'll show you a few more tricks.
I hope you're referring to radio.
Yeah.
Give me a call tomorrow. Maybe I'll go to that derby, that bout, with you. I have to learn the nomenclature. So I'm at the science fiction, between the Science Fiction Writers of America booth, and directly across the row from it was the Horror Writers of America. And I was working the CEFWA booth, and Ellen Datlow was working the Horror Writers of America booth. She of the KGB Fantastic Fiction Reading Series, along with Matt Kressel, who's going to be reading for us in October. Yes, we steal from each other. Why shouldn't we? I mean, he doesn't want to read at his own reading series. That makes sense. So why, So we host him. That's the way to do it. So I'm talking to this person who I've hardly ever met in person, Stefan Rudnicki, of Skyboat Media, for whom I edit audiobooks and I edit Lightspeed Magazine's podcast. And by the way, this week's podcast, Genevieve Valentine, read by Gabrielle DeCure, is a winner. It's a wonderful story. But all that aside, I've only met Stefan, I think, twice in my life. And this was like the first time I'm talking with him and telling him about my life and saying, yeah, I'm doing all this stuff. Now all I have to do is figure out how to monetize this. And this woman walks by and says, monetize? Like, for readings and stuff? I said, well, yes. She said, oh, I can help with that. Why? Because she's a roller derby skater. No, because she works at Kickstarter. And as if that weren't enough, Margot Atwell is a roller derby skater. Now, the last time I was on the air 2 weeks ago, we did a tribute to Margot Adler. And the names are spelt the same way, the proper way, M-A-R-G-O-T. But Margot Atwell is better known to the world as M-Dash, which is a clever, clever, I don't know how many levels there are to that pun, right? Yes, your mic is open.
Okay, great.
And with us also is Zach ZYZ.
Yes, hello. Good evening.
Good evening. Oh, you say yes, you're on mic. It works well. Yes.
Yeah, I come out of a publishing background, so when I went to pick my roller derby name, which they tend to have puns, I thought that M-Dash was kind of fitting. You know, between the speed and the punctuation joke. Seemed like it would work.
Yeah, absolutely. And anybody who does typography or anything, when I taught word processing in the olden days, when people did not yet know what a word processor really was, I took them to the South Street Seaport and showed them a font, this big giant thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I showed them, now here's a letter N. Take out a little dash and put it under that. That's an N dash. Here's a letter M and compare it. And that's an M dash.
So. I tend to have a couple types of fans who are passionate and love my name. It's copy editors and graphic designers, and nobody else gets it.
Yeah, but then take that M, Margot, dash, roller derby, typography.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a publishing company called M-Dash Publications.
I ran an editing and consulting business.
It was
M-Dash and Co. Literary Services.
Okay.
And before that, I was publisher of Beaufort Books.
Right. B BAUFORG for those who aren't watching their radios. And now you are with Gut Punch Press.
Yes. I've been working with
Kickstarter. And I did that without looking at the book.
I've been working with Kickstarter for a bit over a year and a half now. And I'm the publishing outreach lead. So I get to work with people who have publishing-related projects and need to raise money for them.
Yeah.
But I miss the
editing. I'm going to be taking advantage of later this year, but I won't push too much over the radio because I non-commercial radio and all that. I'll let people know where to look for it.
Absolutely. But I missed the editing and the publishing and the nitty-gritty parts of putting together books. So I decided to write my own book about roller derby and publish it through Gut Punch Press, which is going to be doing at least one or two other titles this year. By Zach ZYZ.
And tell us about those titles, Mr. ZYZ.
Oh, well, these are the first two books that I've been able to publish thus far. The first is a novella. It's called Survival Mode, and it tells the story of Kay, a fugitive from justice who's decided he can ride out the statute of limitations.
Just letter K.
Yeah, just kind of like
Kafka-esque or... Men in Black.
And the story involves heavy elements of paranoia, fear, alienation, isolation. It's set on an alien moon called Yal. And basically he's tried to ride out the statute of limitations in a spacecraft going at relativistic speeds. He crash lands on an alien moon with only the AI and his survival suit to keep him company. And he has to engineer a way to stay alive on this world teeming with hostile life.
So this is a documentary.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, as far as any number of people in WBAI are concerned, it would be. Yeah. So, but obviously we're going to have you back on Hour of the Wolf when that comes out in maybe 6 months or so.
That should be out fairly soon. We're finishing the very final stages. We have a cover designed, art
an amazing
is done by,
cover, yeah.
Yeah, it's done by the very talented Clark Huggins. We were able to meet at Gen Con recently. Excellent person. I highly recommend him. It's a joy to work with there. Then he's come up with a very singular vision for it. I grew up working at a used bookstore and just shelving pulp after pulp after pulp. So all these old...
I have to ask, which I've worked in too.
BJ's Books in Warrenton, Virginia. And okay. I spent most of my young adulthood working there. So I've just... All those covers make a tremendous impact on me.
I knew the New York... stores. There are sorrowfully few of them.
Fewer
left.
And fewer every year, yes.
Yeah. But at least one of which, is it Singularity Books?
Yeah, oh, Singularity & Co. was actually Kickstarter funded.
Yes, exactly.
They had the Save the Sci-Fi project where they wanted to digitize out-of-print books.
Right.
And it was so popular that they ended up creating a physical store, which is in Dumbo.
Right.
C.C. James runs that.
Right. I thought they were in Queens at this point. No, they're in Dumbo.
Okay. Yeah,
I've still never been there.
It's wonderful.
Right now I'm working a lot in Dumbo. I have a client there. Amazing neighborhood.
Singularity & Co. does really good events. And if you miss the old pulp look, they just have row after row of pulp sci-fi and fantasy covers and books. So
one reason I dare not go in there is I collect.
Yeah, that would be dangerous.
Yeah, it would be very dangerous. I have kept my habit at a distance for some time now, but the basement of my house is a horror. It's Lovecraftian. It's the books reach out, and my partner Barbara has about as many books as I have. So, and then here's a duplicate. That one's mine. No, it's mine. You know, it's after 26 years of, can we agree these are ours? But
that's actually the hardest part, maybe the worst part about my job, is I see so many amazing book projects coming through Kickstarter that I back them all and just end up turning my paycheck right back over to the company.
Now, when I worked at Coliseum Books,
That was a wonderful bookstore.
Yeah, and I worked there for about 2 years. Mm-hmm. And the owner of the store was very crafty. He gave us 40% off. And on payday, He said, do you want a check or do you want to shop around the 40% discount? And this is evil because he hired people not on the basis as much of how good are you at this. I was doing accounts receivables, but the job interview was, what do you read?
It's cruel to take advantage of addiction like
that. It really is. It really is. It was a great, great store, and I miss it sorely. I shopped there before I worked there and after. But that was in the old location on 57th Street before they moved.
42nd?
Yeah.
That's where they were when I started working in publishing.
Ah, okay, yeah. But they were on 57th Street right near Broadway for years and years in a place that used to be a car showroom. And the 42nd Street location was actually smaller, even though that was pretty good.
Yeah, it was right near Grand Central, which was nice.
Yeah, well, yes, exactly. The more walk-in trade that way. But an independent bookstore in New York today, alas, is not an easy thing to do. Therefore, CeCe James did her Kickstarter. And exactly what does that mean? Your title again? I know I put it online. Lead?
Oh, publishing outreach lead.
Publishing outreach lead. So lead means that you're a leader in that area, I take it.
Yeah, we have. There are two publishing outreach leads at Kickstarter, and each of us has a fairly different background. Mm-hmm. I come out of more independent publishing. I skew towards science fiction and fantasy out of personal interest,
which we're going to get to.
Mm-hmm. She comes much more out of the Big Five. Used to work for Barnes & Noble.
Okay. Yeah.
But my job is to talk to people who have publishing projects in mind, and that's not just necessarily making a book. It could be making a magazine, creating something online.
Running a reading series,
running a radio station or a podcast. That's under the publishing category, too. And I seem to just have inherited the journalism category as well.
Ooh, that's way cool. And I have to introduce you to somebody, but that'll be off the air.
I'm happy to talk to anyone about publishing.
Yeah.
Or journalism.
Yeah. Excellent. Now, how does that fit into your life? What is the pro? Okay, unlike Max, I am new to the world of roller derby outside of knowing the William Harrison short story, The Rollerball Murders, which has been made into two movies, one of which was good.
Well, I can tell you there are no motorcycles in our version of the sport.
No, nobody dies.
Pretty much never.
Yes. Not in your experience. This is, how long have you been doing that? And what's the proper way? I mean, we used to say roller derby queens and stuff. Is that still?
We say players now.
Players, yes.
Yeah, athletes.
That's better. They're all female? I know you're with the Gotham Girls.
Yeah.
We should mention what team you're with and all.
Sure.
That good stuff.
So I began playing roller derby I found it in 2005 and saw my first bout in 2006. Mm-hmm. And I immediately fell in love with the sport. I decided I absolutely had to play. Just one catch, I did not know how to skate on quad roller skates. So it took me a while to get up to speed. But I've been playing with Gotham Girls since 2008. I've been on the world champion Gotham All-Stars for four seasons. They're actually undefeated for 60 bouts in a row, and have won four world championship titles in a row, which is pretty impressive. I'm not with that team anymore because I took a step back to focus more on my career and writing this book.
You're on more than one team.
I have been. Yeah. I was on the All-Stars for 4 years. Last year, I was co-captain of the Wall Street Traitors, T-R-A-I-T-O-R-S.
Yes.
Roller derby.
The 1% of roller derby, yes.
One of the things that attracted me to derby is how geeky it is, with the derby names and the puns and the jokes.
See, I've only been learning that since I first met you, and then I caught a bout on TV. I don't remember what channel it
was. Was that the New York Life Channel, like WNYC?
It was one of those. It was certainly those are local public channel.
Those are our bouts, actually. We produce those shows, and so they've been airing our bouts for a few years.
Yeah, and I caught one, maybe 8 or 9 months ago, in the middle of the night.
Yes, if you're the type of person who's up listening to Jim's show, you might also catch us on television.
Yes, absolutely.
Because we are it's 1 or 2 a.m.
Yes, or you can record it.
It's true.
So is time sharing, just like with this radio program, because we'll be available. Yes, I made sure of that. We're good. We're good on the archive, so you will have a copy of the show.
Great.
But now, and you may be on WBAI again. Rumor has it with Max Schmid this Sunday at 11 p.m. If everything works out correctly, and that's pure roller derby talk.
I'll come back to WBAI as often as I'm invited, and apparently at any time.
Watch out! Watch out. We're greedy people for good radio, and cycling back, because there are so many fun levels to talk to you on. There's the business level. People, now I trust and hope, by the way, that listeners know what Kickstarter is. There is this phenomenon that Kickstarter really started, I believe, called crowdfunding. And the idea, by the way, it's 2 o'clock or a little after, so I have to do some proper station break. Pardon me. WBAI. New York. See, I used to do that, Professor. Anyway, crowdfunding means that somebody has a premise there. They would be an entrepreneur to do a project. And maybe you should explain this.
Sure.
It's your profession.
Kickstarter, we say, is a place where people come to raise funds and build community around a creative idea. Mm-hmm. And it was started by three folks about 6.5 years ago. It launched. And they came out of an arts and music background. Yancey used to work as a music journalist, and his partner, Perry, came out of the art world. He had this idea years and years ago, over a decade ago, when he lived in New Orleans, that he wanted to bring this famous DJ to town. And he knew that people would be excited if they, you know, if they had that opportunity. But he didn't have $20,000 to put this on and fly the DJ in. Mm-hmm. And he thought, wouldn't it be great if I could just reach out to all the people who would want this to happen and only charge their cards if we got a critical mass?
Yeah. Which is, by the way, similar to the way things work in theater. When you're trying to put together a Broadway show, a la The Producers or something like that, you establish what they call in theater, and this was 30 years ago when I was working in theater, the nut. And you did not get your money until all the angels, the investors, bought 100 points. You sell 200 points. That would be 50% of the show. Once you do that, then you get the money to produce the show.
It's a very old concept, actually. It used to be also that when people would want to produce a print run of books, they would get subscribers. And so people would pay money to kind of subscribe to the print run so that people knew that there was the interest in it.
And well, that goes back to Hogarth.
Yeah.
That goes to the 17th century. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then they would be, you know, thanked in the book or have their names in the book and get a copy of it. Kickstarter is essentially that in the modern age online.
Yeah.
So you put up your idea, you tell people, I want to make this thing, whether it's a sci-fi novel or a podcast or an album.
Or all of the above.
Or all of the above. I've definitely seen cool cross-category projects.
Uh-huh.
And then if enough people believe that your idea is as cool as you do and put up their money in exchange for cool rewards, then you get to make your project. I really was very excited to run my own campaign in the fall last year. I was writing the Derby book anyway.
The Derby book? We haven't said this enough
yet. All right, yes. So my book is called Derby Life, A Crash Course in the Incredible Sport of Roller Derby. It came out of 3 or 4 years of me running derbylife.com and being in and around the sport for almost a decade. So I was writing this book, and I wanted to know if anyone out there in the world, derby or otherwise, cared. I didn't want to spend, you know, another 12 months of my life making a physical book if no one actually wanted that book. So I put up a project on Kickstarter. I asked for $7,000, which is the budget that it would take to make this little 160-page book, was my original plan. And I got a really outstanding response. 254 people contributed just over $9,000.
Yeah.
And
what was the goal originally?
$7,000.
Right.
So not only did I get to make my book, but I hit my stretch goal, which was if I got $8,000, I would include images. And Jim, you have a copy in front of you.
Yes,
you can flip
I do.
Through it. You'll see that there are...
And it's autographed. It's pre-autographed.
But if you flip through, you'll see that there are 16 gorgeous black and white roller derby images by some of the best photographers in the business.
Mm. Those are stunning. They really are. And who's on the cover, by the way? Who is that?
That is Susie Hot Rod. She is on the Queens of Pain. They're going to be at the Gotham Girls Roller Derby Championship on the 29th of August.
In Coney.
I think it's out at Coney Island.
Yeah.
So last year, my team played hers in the championship.
And your team is the
Manhattan Mayhem.
Right.
And we had an undefeated championship season last year. This year, we had some bad luck. We had some injuries. So unfortunately, we're not going back to the championship. But we're already looking at 2016.
That's because you've been concentrating on other things now.
Shh, don't tell my team.
For your team members listening, no. Tune out for the next 60 seconds. Well, anyway.
I actually just finished practice at 9 o'clock earlier. So I had dinner and took a little bit of a rest.
Yeah, I'm so stupid about this kind of stuff. When I said to you yesterday through email, let's talk on the phone about this, you said, well, I'll try to get in touch with you after 9:30. I thought, oh, that's strange. And doesn't she get off Kickstarter at like 5 o'clock or something like that?
But I work longer hours than that, but
yeah, well,
but I do
7:30 or whatever. But yeah,
I skate.
It's almost 10 o'clock.
Yeah, I skate for 2 or 3 hours about 3 times a week, and I've been doing that for the last 8 years.
Yeah,
pretty much consistently.
Yeah, and that keeps you in the shape you are in. And by the way, I did Instagram you, so people can look on Instagram or Twitter or what's that thing called? Facebook.
I have an M-dash page on Facebook.
Yes.
And I'm on Twitter also.
Yeah. And I actually tweeted. Well, you and I were talking. I did one this afternoon, which you retweeted, but I set up also one saying, show starts in 15 minutes, because I always figure Twitter is really immediate. Facebook is for people who plan things out and all that, but Twitter is like, do this now!
Maybe that's why I like Facebook better. I'm a planner. It comes back from my managing editor days.
Yeah, no, I like Facebook better as well, but I like BBSs. They're gone. They're all gone. I was a BBS sysop, and
that's actually I met my author Zach ZYZ on sort of a BBS throwback. It wasn't a true BBS, but it called itself one.
Right. It's a web form. But
same conversation premise. But I met my partner 5 years before I met her on several BBSs. We just kept running into each other, and then we had so I met her online in about 1981, okay? But we met physically like in 86 or 87 or something like that, when everybody from one BBS went to a movie. It was Willow, so that's how we can figure out exactly when it was. It was the opening day of Willow. So, but that was an actual dial-in BBS with one phone line. And here's the thing. the software they had on Magpie software was the name of the software, is better than anything that's online today, because you could have threads, real threads. So somebody posts a message, right? Okay, that's a parent message. Then somebody posts a reply to it, and somebody else posts a different reply that really is slightly off topic. We're drawing a diagram here. And so you can work down through threads. And when you dial back in, you read all the messages in threads in the order that you had left them before. Pick up all of your messages, read them offline. Anyway, from that I went to CompuServe professionally. I was a whiz up on CompuServe for Ziff Data. So yeah, I went through all these things. But yeah, BBSs are great. And web boards are great. They just need better software.
It's the same thing, like a persistent community of people where they have a chance to build up sort of a culture where some people hate each other, some people love each other, people have time to argue because they're they're not just spitting something out and then everybody reacts to it and then it's forgotten. The reputation follows you around forever on a forum.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that everybody out there listening has some argument that they made on a forum maybe 10 years ago that somebody could dig up on Google to this very day.
I mean, my review of that movie Willow, I wrote it up for a BBS, which was not on the internet.
Was it a positive review or?
A mixed review. I liked the movie overall. I thought it was an original fantasy. I thought some of the Stan Winston special effects, like when Willow jumps on top of the dragon, you can see the puppet, you can see the strings and all that. Morphing for its day.
For its day, it was not bad at all.
Yeah, exactly.
Van Mardigan is turned into a pig and...
Yes, absolutely. And introduced us to Val Kilmer and John Wally Kilmer.
I think it's the test of time, more or less. You'll still hear every so often somebody will make a reference to it. Mostly centered around Mad Mardigan. I'm not going to do the voice, but... No, it's pretty ridiculous. But yeah, it's actually held up pretty well. I remember, I think we had a VHS of it, so I've seen it probably about 100 times.
And that, nor Howard the Duck, is... Neither of those are George Lucas's worst movie.
No, not at all.
His worst movie was set in a radio station.
Oh, which one was this?
Oh, what's the name of it?
It wasn't like talk radio, was it?
No. That's
talk radio was fantastic. That's
Eric Bogosian.
Oh, okay.
I had on my show. No. Oh, it was fantastic. Like, not Manhattan Murder Mystery. That's Woody Allen. Somebody's going to text me in a moment and tell me what it is. I have no doubt. You've got your
I can consult the Oracle. I can find out here. There.
I actually named my new iPhone the Oracle because I said consult the Oracle so many times.
Right, but then people will think that it's made by Oracle. It's a tech company.
not for long. They're almost forgotten.
Yeah,
Radioland Murders.
That's it.
Set in a 1939 atmosphere
with
old time radio.
Benben. And here's a movie I ought to love. It's historically important. It's the first movie that's all blue screen.
Huh.
There were like no sets whatsoever. It was the first CGI film.
It was way ahead of its time. Like nowadays, everything is CGI.
Absolutely. Now all they needed was a movie. And it would appeal to me on every level because it had great tech. It had a cast I like, Brian Benben, who was starring on a show that I liked at the time, and Wendy, I'm forgetting her last name, but good cast, set in a radio station during an old-time radio drama, and the script stunk. It just stunk. But that's George Lucas's worst movie. I mean, it doesn't even approach Phantom Menace.
Didn't recoup its budget, and it attained a 20% approval on Rotten Tomatoes, which is pretty terrible for such a successful director. I've never even heard of it.
It's worth seeing for the reasons I mentioned. Yes, yeah. But my, how we have digressed. And Margot, you're going to read something from your book in a while. But or maybe should we do that now because we've been talking Doiby for a while?
Sure. I can read the piece. The book is, I'll give you a little bit of background.
Please.
I wanted to create the book I wished I'd found when I started the sport. Because it's a fairly new sport in its most recent incarnation, although today is actually the 80th anniversary of the birth of the sport.
Today
yes, being August 13th.
Excellent. Okay.
1935. In the Chicago Coliseum, the first ever transcontinental roller derby happened. And there's a piece about what that history is on derbylife.com. But so I wanted to create resources, because the modern sport of derby, it's very DIY. Everyone creates resources and shares them around, and we're all kind of learning together. So the book is the history of the sport, the culture, how to get into it, how to keep going and improve, build mental toughness, deal with injuries. And then the last section is 16 personal stories from people who play the sport. And what I'll be reading is my story about how I got started.
So, yeah, looking forward. You and I discussed this before the book came out when it was... I should mention, by the way, I haven't even mentioned, Kickstarter is this, you know, huge phenomenon. And I meet this woman, who you are now hearing on the air, at BEA. I never quite finished that story because I said I have to learn how to monetize this. And she said, I can help you with that. And I'm thinking, well, Kickstarter, they've got to be in Silicon Valley, right? They've got to be in California. They're in Brooklyn. They're one of us.
Yeah, we're up in Greenpoint.
Yeah.
We moved in last year.
Live stream, I just discovered. We're putting the reading series now on live stream. Live stream is like within three blocks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I just discovered that because I was looking at something. Oh, my own reading. And by the way, listeners, you can catch previews of what our readings are going to look like by going to livestream.com and searching for NYRSF, New York Review of Science Fiction readings. And we have one with Chip Delaney and Sam J. Miller, and an interview, the first on-camera Hour of the Wolf, more or less, with Rob Shearman, who's a writer for Doctor Who and a horror writer and wonderful, wonderful guy in general, who did a fabulous reading, a story about Snoopy's funeral and stuff like that. And then N.K. Jemisin and Cherie Renee Thomas. Those are all available at live stream. Three blocks from Kickstarter. So who knew?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm amazed that and when I came to visit you, I ran into, we won't name names, but colleagues from the science fiction world who are doing unknown secret projects there.
Yeah.
Which are very cool.
Yeah, it's a wonderful crew of people, and I feel really lucky to get to work with such smart, passionate, artistic people.
And it's a wonderful atmosphere. Any place that has, you know, hot and cold running coffee.
It's true. We literally have iced coffee on tap, which is the only thing that keeps us going.
Yeah, and
that and our love.
And I live on that, although I have to say I don't love cold brew. But I should have made my own and brought my own. I make great iced coffee. I'm sorry. I digress way too much. You were saying about your book, Derby Life, just out from Gut Punch Press.
Mm-hmm.
You were saying?
Yeah.
And by the way, available online and in better brick-and-mortar stores.
Well, better brick-and-mortar stores that it's available in are all roller derby shops. So there's Five Stride Skate Shop in New York, if you want to get it in person.
Okay.
I figured that I would do a lot of outreach towards the derby community first, because that's really my number one.
And you've just been touring the country.
It's true. Yeah, I went to Las Vegas for RollerCon, which is 7,500 people took over a casino in Las Vegas. In July. It used to be the Riviera, but they knocked it down. So this year...
It was not a... It was a porn palace. It really was. I used to go to Vegas all the time for Comdex, which is the computer huge show. I mean, you know, 250,000 people. That has since become CES, or CES has supplanted it. Mm-hmm. So I used to go every year to Comdex. So I know Vegas. Boy, I love where everybody else is going to gamble. I would go to the Flamingo to see penguins in the desert. I mean, where else can you go and watch water, a precious rare resource, be squandered in such a manner?
It's... Vegas is a very strange place. I've been there twice, both times for RollerCon.
Yeah, no, I've been there about a dozen times, although not in 10 years.
This year, so my new phone has a fitness tracker, which is just kind of always on.
Yeah.
And I've become a little obsessed with it because I respond to game mechanics. I'm that kind of nerd. So I discovered one day that I managed to walk 8.5 miles without ever leaving the casino.
Yeah.
How do you do that? Walk 8.5 miles without leaving a hotel? It was completely baffling to
yeah,
me.
Yeah, it's like, oh, where are you going to? You're going from the Mirage to Caesar's Palace. It's right next door, and it is. It's about 3/4 of a mile
yeah,
just to go from one casino to the entrance of one casino to the entrance of another. But these places are humongous.
Yeah, the scale is incredible. I mean, 7,500 Derby people were only a portion of the people who were there.
Yeah.
There was also a basketball tournament, a woodworkers convention, and women selling purses. And all of us were at the hotel at the same time. And it was very, very strange. The woodworkers were very nice, but they didn't know quite what to make of us. The basketball players and the Derby players just kind of looked at each other like, yeah, you know, you got your Gatorade, I got my Gatorade, got our sports attire, whatever, we're doing our own thing. But the women who sold purses could not wrap their minds around what we were doing.
I don't know. I think, well, at least they would have probably gotten along with the woodworkers.
Potentially.
Yeah. Potentially. Okay, I have wasted all this time, although it's been so much fun, but I would love to hear from the book.
Great. I'll start that now.
And I'm sure I'm getting texts from Melissa saying, shut up, Jim, let your guests talk. And they'd be right.
How I got rolling. I discovered roller derby just after graduating from college in 2005, when my mom gave me an article about it, thinking I might want to see about. The billboard across the street from my dismally paid first job in New York City advertised the A&E series Roller Girls. I was intrigued, but I had a lot to pay attention to. It wasn't till the summer of 2006 that I finally made it to about. The details are blurry, but I have a few strong, lingering impressions of bright colors, campy outfits, and funny names. I'm pretty sure the irrepressible banana mascot, Bane Anna, was there. But the thing I remember most was the passion. Skaters might have been wearing tutus and swinging floggers around in the introductions, but they were deadly serious once the whistle blew. A skater got her nose broken by another skater's elbow, which I later learned wasn't legal. But in spite of that, I was hooked. My friend and I spent the drive home brainstorming our new derby names. Within a week or two, I had bought myself a set of cheap, terrible quad figure skates from Modell's. I discovered a local group called Sweet Action Skate Club, a group of women and a few men who met up after work to roller skate and then drink beer at a local bar. The skate club's name derived from our favorite local brewing company. Several of the other skaters aspired to try out for the New York League Gotham Girls Roller Derby. The league hadn't yet developed its dominant reputation. Gotham lost to Providence Roller Derby that year. We tried to skate as much as we could, attending ladies' night at Empire Roller Skating Rink and taking our lives in our hands, skating down a steep hill at a local park. When tryouts rolled around, we were all nervous. Knowing I couldn't do anything more about my skating skills at that point, I wore a flamboyant, short, red and white satin cheerleader-style skirt to make myself stand out. Tryouts took place at my local hangout, Empire, allegedly the birthplace of roller disco. I had spent many nights there learning to skate to R&B music, so at least I was comfortable with the setting and the floor. The Gotham girls had set up stations to check us in, but with so many people trying out, it was a scene of barely organized chaos. Eventually, we were given race-style numbers and safety pins, then put our gear on and met out on the track. Several Gotham coaches would demonstrate a skill, then ask us to copy it a few times. Some, skating, stopping, were familiar to me, but others, the Toonie Rockstar Fall, which has since fallen out of favor, were new. I felt good about tryouts till the very end, when they brought us to the large rink and made us skate as fast as we could for a set period of time. It could have been 5 minutes or only two, but it felt like an hour. I thought I was going to die. The rink was hot, and my wheels slid around on the worn wooden floor. Even though I was supposed to be skating as fast as possible, I was tempted to linger in the narrow part of the track with a fan. After tryouts, I waited anxiously for what felt like ages, but didn't hear back. Gotham was in the process of moving into its new home, the inconveniently located warehouse they called the Crash Pad. Finally, I got an invitation to return for callbacks. The coaches asked us to wear the same thing we had worn to tryouts, and I seriously regretted the skirt, which I had discovered was very impractical for skating in. I don't remember much except that I slipped all over the Crash Pad's slick blue plastic floor, which was made of a material they called Sport Court. A week later, the day of the Gotham-hosted screening of the Modern Derby documentary Hell on Wheels, I got an email informing me that I hadn't made it. As a tall skater, you'll have a particular challenge with balance unless you get lower, it read. I was devastated. It was even harder on me that two of my crew had made it. I cried a few tears, but then went to the movie. I had already bought a ticket, and I wanted to congratulate my friends. At the party after the screening, I met a Gotham skater in a cowboy hat, Ginger Snap, who was friendly and encouraging. I resolved to try out again. In a movie, this would be where the montage starts. I skated as much as humanly possible. At first, I skated at Empire until the rink closed its doors in April 2007 after 66 years in operation. After that, I skated outside, sometimes with Sweet Action or others I'd met at tryouts, sometimes by myself or with my boyfriend. I'd skate to brunch on the weekends or roll around on the fabulously smooth but grippy linoleum floors of the nearby grocery store, startling other shoppers. That summer, skating up the West Side Highway one evening after work, another derby-obsessed friend told me that she had heard a new league was starting in Westchester, a local suburb. We decided to check it out, even though it was about an hour and a half from my apartment in Brooklyn. We trekked out to Westchester a few days later and met a scrappy group of about a dozen skaters of different skill levels on a cracked concrete basketball court in a park. It was one of the first meetings of the nascent Suburbia Roller Derby, so we talked about what the league would be, what the goals were, and how to recruit other players, and then skated around a bit on the badly maintained surface, ducking around the tufts of grass sprouting through the concrete. I was hooked. I skated with Suburbia twice a week for the next few months, getting better at skating, stopping, and being in a pack with other people. I upgraded my skates and wheels to a pair of actual quad derby skates and wondered how I had ever skated on the cheap white dance skates I had been wearing for a year. Though I loved the other skaters on Suburbia, I couldn't handle the commute. I'd have to leave work at about 5 in the afternoon and wouldn't get back to Brooklyn until about midnight. When Gotham tryouts came around again, I realized I either had to make it or probably had to stop skating, since the commute was just too disruptive to my career and relationship. This time, Gotham's coaches ran a few skills nights before tryouts, so I was able to skate with other hopefuls and learn the skills that I'd need for tryouts from coaches who were already skaters in the league. My 9 months of obsessive skating and 4 months with Suburbia had paid off. I was much more steady on my skates, and my fitness level was way better than it had been the previous year. I befriended one of the other skaters at the skills nights, and we spent a few evenings and rainy weekend days skating around her office, which had beautiful painted concrete floors. We looped in between the cubicles, down to the kitchenette, where we used our plows and tee stops, then turned around and did it all over again. We wanted to be ready for tryouts. This time, I felt much more prepared and steady on my skates. I guess for me, the second time was the charm, and I made it. A week or so later, Gotham's 2007 end-of-year party happened, and I dressed up and volunteered to work the door with some of the other fresh meat. Standing there among my new league mates that night, I couldn't imagine how much my life was about to change.
You've been listening to M-Dash, a.k.a. Margot Atwell, reading from her book, Derby Life. This is Some Guy.
With the girl I saw on a ballroom TV screen. Well, I was just getting ready to get my hair when she caught my eye and I put it back and I ordered myself a couple of more shots and beers.
Jim Croce, Roller Derby Queen. Whoops, why is it by my intro? Jeez. This is, not speaking of jeez, this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and available on WBAI.org. And coming up, by the way, in half an hour, 28 minutes or something like that, is Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming, well, as I just said, in 28 minutes. So with us this morning is Margot Atwell, M-Dash to Roller Derby fans, and Zach ZYZ, known as Zach ZYZ to science fiction fans, will be. As your first novella is coming out, and
very shortly, before the end of the year.
Before the end of the year, yep. Well, so we'll have to do another show with you taking lead on that one.
Indeed, indeed.
And you're podcasting?
So, yeah, I also produce I run a Twitch stream.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I know. We stream League of Legends. I'm known as the legendary Teemo Jungle.
Yeah, I am a solo player, I have to say. I you know, when I see anything outside of the old style multiplayer dungeons, I mean, we're talking ASCII graphics, outside of that, I started with the Infocom games.
Oh, Zork.
Absolutely. I had all of the Infocom writers on this show at one time.
Really?
When they would do their tours to promote their books, they would come to Hour of the Wolf first. I'm very proud of that, including Douglas Adams.
That's fantastic.
When he did his games. And I premiered Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the radio show in this country.
I remember that story. Yeah.
Illegally, but... But
won't talk about that.
Oh, yes, we will. Oh, the pirate was, now it can be said, Douglas Adams. So if anybody wants to go after him, good luck. So he just accidentally, we used to broadcast a lot of BBC stuff legally, WBAI, and we had these special transcription players that could only play these proprietary BBC discs. And Mr. Adams was doing a tour to promote this TV show that he was working on called Doctor Who.
I've heard of it.
Yes, he was the script editor at the time. He almost was trying to bring this fellow named Tom Baker, but he wasn't able to make it. But I had Adams on the program, and he accidentally left six of these transcription discs. He did the same thing at our sister station in L.A. with Mike Hodel of KPFK. So I premiered it, and Mike, some fans think Mike did it, but you see, Mike didn't do it till 4 days after me. Mm. So I claim, and I did all six episodes in one day. Mike spent 6 weeks at it. So anyway, sorry. At any rate, in the course of your learning, or not learning, but getting up to speed with being the publishing outreach lead, did I get it right without mm-hmm. looking it up for once, at Kickstarter, you were also starting to feed your interest in science fiction. And when I met you at Kickstarter on a glorious day on the rooftop of that building, you asked me about what books I would recommend, and you had a notebook, and you'd been collecting advice from people and coming up your reading. And I'm just like, oh, how wonderful is this? Because if I can do anything with this radio show, and with the Lightspeed Magazine podcast that I do the audio editing on and host, and the reading series and all that, is outreach. It's to get people to read this stuff. And so I don't read science fiction. Some of them don't even read fiction. And it's like, no, this is relevant. This has meaning, and it's fun. Let's not forget that. So I was wondering how your journeys have been going. For a while, when we were talking last, you were concentrating on novels.
Yes. So a long time ago, I started editing fantasy novels, and I kept getting the same pushback from the authors, which was, that's just kind of a trope in the genre. And finally, I said, okay, I'm going to have to educate myself in fantasy. And I did, and I found that I loved it. So back when I was running my editing company, I started to get inquiries and jobs from science fiction writers.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that I was going to have to do a similar education in sci-fi, because there are a lot of conventions in the science fiction genre and a lot that people are pulling from, that if you haven't read Asimov and Heinlein and all of them, you just don't get. You don't know what they're referencing. And, you know, is this original or is it a horrible cliche? If you haven't read it,
or is it a good cliche?
Yeah, absolutely. Or is it, you know, a spinoff or a send up or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
So I started creating, I had this fabulous vision when I was freelancing and had tons of time that I was going to do a sci-fi canon reading project. So I started asking friends, colleagues, and people who seem to be smart or passionate sci-fi people, who should I read? Who should I start with? And I just assumed that novels would be where to go. So I read...
That's largely what I talked to you about.
Yes.
But I am... We'll get to that.
Sure. So I read Asimov's The Gods Themselves, which is a very weird book. And I later discovered that that's not one of his most famous works.
Nor one of his better.
I disagree. It's one of my favorites.
Is it really?
Yeah, believe it or not. I like it better than a lot of A-list titles.
You know, it's not a bad book by any means whatsoever. And he was trying to reach. He was trying to go beyond what he had been doing in the golden days.
Oh, absolutely.
It was very much a not John W. Campbell book. So he was spreading his wings, as it were.
I should state that it's a good third of a book, because I like one third of The Gods Themselves. The Gods Themselves is broken up into three separate sections, which feature different characters. And his real groundbreaking work appears in the second section. And without giving too much away, in the second section, it deals with a race of aliens that have three discrete sexes, and their trials and tribulations and their socializing and so forth. And he really steps.
And that actually did work.
Yeah, it very well. He did a fantastic job of it.
For a person who was sexually immature, he showed up on the Dick Cavett Show. I was there. Wearing a bra for a mask as the mysterious Dr. A, I swear to God. Okay. And Cavett stopped the taping and said, just take that off. And they, you know, to stop a TV show recording that's being broadcast at night, it's a very expensive and thing to do, but Ike, well. My very first show, by the way, on WBAI with me as host was with Asimov. And I was the very last person to interview him.
Mm. Mm. So I read The Time Traveler. I read Martian Chronicles and Stranger in a Strange Land. And as I got more into the science fiction community, I realized that people were doing very, very cool things with short fiction now. And I started to see all of these cool fiction anthology projects come through Kickstarter. Science fiction, fantasy, and sort of everything in between.
I suspect a project that I'm working on right now, I think that went through Kickstarter. Women Destroy Science Fiction. Didn't that go through Kickstarter?
Yes. Yeah, that was incredibly successful.
Through a Kickstarter project. I didn't know that. Although, no, I am. For Lightspeed Magazine, I earn an honorarium. For audiobooks, it's not an honorarium, he said happily. And this is an audiobook.
So yeah, that was a wonderful project. And John Joseph Adams ran another project more recently, Queers Destroy Science Fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And they hit their whole ladder of stretch goals. So queers get to destroy horror and
fantasy in October.
Yep, everything's being destroyed.
Yeah.
And he's got another project coming up soon, which you can probably find out on his website.
Yeah, well, I'm privy to it, but I shouldn't. It's not his website. I'm on his spreadsheet. You see, I know the JJA secrets. And by the way, John will be hosting the New York Review of Science Fiction Reading in November. He'll be in New York, and he's going to have a number of his writers.
Excellent. I'll have to check it out.
Appearing for us. Yes, you will. It's right here. It's in this building. I was going to say it's right here. It's in this building, 388 Atlantic Avenue, on the ground floor, though. We're on the third floor at the Brooklyn Commons Cafe, which is newly renovated and way cool. So
yeah, I've been reading things like that, things like Rose Fox and Daniel Jose Older's Long Hidden anthology. Neil Clark does just phenomenal work with his Clark's World. Mm-hmm. I haven't checked out his new publication yet.
Yes.
But I'm excited to.
For which he had a new photo made. And Neil, trying to scare everybody. This is the sweetest person in the world. He does this horrible scowling.
Yeah, he's good.
Icon. People. Yes.
So I've been sort of, I've diverged from my original project and I'm kind of splashing around with what people are writing now. And I have to say that one of my original concerns about reading science fiction was the sexism in a lot of the sort of historical canon science fiction. But are so many wonderful people writing now from so many different perspectives.
There are still many barriers to be broken, you know, for a literature that is supposed to be about the future, that is supposed to be about the ultimate in outreach or the opposite in incursions. Science fiction has often been very short-sighted.
Mm-hmm.
So that certain anthologies, certain books sort of help break those molds. And I've done this rap on the air way too often. But for example, as far as women are concerned, for years there was C.L. Moore, there was U.K. Le Guin in Playboy magazine, no less. U.K. Le Guin. And and so forth. There was an anthology, Women of Wonder, edited by Pamela Sargent, which really, like, announced to the world, hey, guess what? Women are writing this stuff. And there was an anthology in 2000 by Cherie Renee Thomas called Dark Matter, which announced black people are writing this, or people from the African diaspora. I'm sorry, Cherie. Don't hurt me, please. And so forth. Only recently have we started breaking the barrier to Asian fantasy, thanks largely to Ken Liu.
We went to his coffee clash at ReaderCon this year, and he's fabulous. And he told a story about how he had written Way of Kings.
It's called The Grace of Kings.
Oh, Grace of Kings, excuse
yes.
me. In, I think, 30-minute chunks on his commute to work, which is incredible because it's quite a long book.
Yeah, I will be broadcasting my interview with him from ReaderCon in 3 weeks. I got a lot of good interviews at ReaderCon.
It's a great event. I've been going for the past 2 years.
It's my favorite con. It really is. You know, it's like I'll give up WorldCon, especially this year's. Although I had to vote. I had to vote, but we won't discuss puppies. Much. ReaderCon is for me, the name says it all. And there are a few conventions like that. There's CapClave in October, but you can't do CapClave and World Fantasy because they're like a week apart. But I have friends in Washington, so I go to CapClave. And next year, LunaCon will come back. We skipped the year. There will be a rebirth of a New York science fiction convention next year, and it should be a very good one.
When is that?
It's usually on Easter weekend, about March 15th.
Great, so, I'll put it in my calendar.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. I hope that I will. I'm pretty sure I will be doing stuff there, so I have historically in the past. So I hope that I will be doing so. For next year's ReaderCon. It's actually in Westchester, but Rye. You know, so
I grew up there.
Well, there you go. So it's at the Rye Town Hilton.
I know exactly where that is.
Okay, yeah, so.
Definitely go.
Yeah, we call it the Escher Hotel because you walk on one floor and you're on the third floor and then you take a look and you're on the seventh floor, but you have not taken any stairs or elevator. You just, it's built on a hill.
That seems like a really kind of fitting thing for a science fiction convention.
It is. It really is. Yeah. I also find it very interesting that you've moved in terms of your reading and study from the long form to the short form. Mm-hmm. Because as a person who produces formally 2-hour radio shows and currently 90-minute, what I specialize in are short stories. And Lightspeed magazine we have the most professional actors, wonderful, wonderful actors, reading the stories. But what I do between Hour of the Wolf and the reading series is I have the authors reading their own work, who may not be as perfect with their voice, but they know their characters. And I am a huge, huge fan of the short form. And yes, I think that the fact that so many magazines are online, like Lightspeed and Clerk's World and Abyss and Apex and a lot of fine, fine magazines, the fact that a lot of science fiction is moving to the internet means that you don't have to only publish a novel now. You can work a novella. And this is also true of the better side of self-publishing.
Yeah, I think that the digital tools that are available have really expanded what kind of counts as a work that you can publish. You know, when you needed to put something between covers, you had to kind of justify doing that and making a physical object and distributing it. And there was a certain amount of cost that was just inherent in it. But now that you can put something up on a website or sell it as an ebook, you can take so many more risks. Yeah. And that's one of the things I'm really excited to do with Gut Punch, is not subscribe to traditional publishing truisms. I mean, I've worked in traditional publishing and semi-traditional publishing, and I'm very excited about the idea of kind of doing things my own way, whether that be the traditional way or otherwise. And I say that we're publishing intriguing nonfiction and weird fiction.
Okay. And can you tell us anything about this yet?
About weird fiction or...
Well, yeah, what you're publishing and
I didn't want to call it science fiction and fantasy because I think everyone has a specific idea of what that means.
I use the Damon Knight definition. He used the term science fiction. And when somebody said, what do you mean by that? He said, science fiction is what I'm pointing at. And that is the definition I use.
Well, that's a wonderful one for the radio.
It is, absolutely. Especially since people can't see where I'm pointing.
Absolutely.
But that's the point. Pun intended, that's the point. You can't box it in.
I like the phrase weird fiction, and there was an article recently about what people meant by that. But to me, it's kind of anything that pushes boundaries or is a little offbeat or is dark or experimental or... I love magical realism. I've been revisiting Angela Carter, who...
Oh, one of the best.
...is phenomenal. I think it's so tragic that she died so young.
Yeah.
For many reasons, but partly because I bet she had another dozen or two brilliant books in her.
Yeah. That's happened horribly so often, you know.
Yeah, I think...
Her and Octavia Butler and...
I think Wise Children is one of the best novels.
Yes,
period.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Nights at the Circus is great. It's one of the best circus books ever written.
Yes. Oh, circus books have a special place.
Yeah.
Genevieve Valentine's first novel, Mécanique, A Tale of the Circus Trizalti.
That's on my to-read list.
But listen to this week's Lightspeed for her new short story.
I will.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually.
Or you can read it also, but...
I like reading things, but I probably shouldn't say that to a radio host.
Or to the editor of the podcast.
Probably not. For you, I'll listen to the podcast.
Do that, because Gabrielle DeCure does the reading, and she is magnificent. She really is. And Genevieve, by the way, used to be the movie reviewer of this radio program.
I actually met her at the Kickstarter-hosted science fiction and fantasy editors panel a year ago.
I was there.
Yeah.
Yes.
But yeah, I say weird fiction because I don't want to define what we get. I just like fiction that's not, you know, a man and his wife and their marriage problems in the suburbs. Like,
yeah. Historically, the only issue for the long-timers like me is that weird fiction meant Lovecraft, Weird Tales magazine.
Gotcha.
Defined weird fiction. And then that sort of ebbed for a while. Then Jeff and Vandermeer created the new Weird, and we're also editing the newer version of Weird Tales.
Mm.
So the Weird, so, I mean, is to many of us a subgenre of that undefinable genre that we're discussing.
Hmm. Well, maybe I'll have to revisit this, but...
Zach, you have an opinion.
Vandermeer is definitely weird.
he is, yeah, absolutely.
I really enjoyed the first book of the Southern Reach trilogy there. It just...
Keep going.
It's really fantastic.
It only
gets
better.
So I started on the second there, and I stalled out about halfway through. Mm-hmm. And it just, he spends a lot of time establishing the sort of bureaucratic character, and I just couldn't relate.
It's a second book. Yeah. That's often, you know, the mid-book, the Two Towers problem, you know.
So how does it work out? Is it worth pushing through for the rest
yes,
of the series?
Yes, the third book is, yes, right. Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
That's given me energy to try once more, because it is one that I intended to
return to. The Nebula Award nomination, the Hugo nomination, to sort of like should be a clue.
Well deserved. that first book really, I picked it up, and then it's one of those books where you just start telling everybody, wow, you've got to read
this. And
I'll
email you my interview.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I'd love to read that, yeah. Or hear it.
Absolutely. So, wow, we have like, where's the clock? It's over there. 2 minutes left before I have to put on our outro theme music. So let's review what we need to promote here. First of all, you have Derby Life, subtitled A Crash Course in the incredible sport of roller derby by Margot M-Atwell. And it's wonderful. I trust you're going to have another roller derby book at some point.
Oh, boy.
I think that you should be doing a roller derby book, an anthology of weird or science fiction or fantasy stories. Start with The Rollerball Murders by William Harrison and work your way from there.
I have a new anthology project in mind, but that will have to be for another night.
Yes,
I'm still working on it.
I hope there
Derby
will
Life.
Be another night or day if you need to record during the day. We can manage that. But if we can manage to take listener calls, then I'd like you live. You know, otherwise, we can record. Otherwise, what should people know about what you are doing and going and stuff like that? Where can people...
People can find me online, gutpunchpress.com. The book's also available on Amazon, but I tend to push people towards the publisher websites.
Absolutely, absolutely, especially when they're independent publishers. Jacob Weissman told me, we're not small press, we're independent. I agree. That's the better word to use. Zach, what about you?
You can also on gutpunchpress.com. You can view the cover for Survival Mode, which should be out later this fall. It'll be available as an ebook, and we'll be doing a limited print run.
All righty.
Well, thank you so much for having us on,
thank
Jim.
You for having us.
Thank
wonderful.
You. Okay, so my that's pleasure. Zach, ZYZ, by the way, and Margot with a T, Atwell, like 2 weeks ago, Margot with a T, Adler. I'll talk in the air some other time about how I get freaked out when I get emails from Margot Atwell. It's like, that's another story, but you all know it. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Margot and Zach. Lister, and I'll be back next week with... We're overloaded with great interviews and readings and stuff, so I hope you'll be here for Hour of the Wolf. And stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn with Lister. Clapper with Lister. Come your way as soon as I can get out of the sea. And please, everybody, be good to each other. Treat each other well. We and you all deserve it. Good morning.
When I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am. And you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the
bitch.
The red, white, and blue is spit on you.
Expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. While I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk my people, the people around the peace work. Tell me I'm wrong, though that's my right in this in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the for the brother, and I'm no lover of this flag. Like many others take the same turn, like me, they yearn for the flag too. Burn the material of the imperialist in a blazing inferno. A nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies, the pigs, makeup, imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist, cause I ain't taking. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison? Cause I'm Nazi attacking the flag. I ragging and snagging and dragging and ripping to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy. I'm the Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fast. And watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the message must be. That's why the red, white, and blue burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this shit. Other places will hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talking about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy, Moran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx.
Just a motherfucking minute. Gave me freedom of speech in the first amendment.
See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
So won't sink into the scene at the lyrics of my mouth. Come on, time better up on the scene.